Today on Against the Grain. For decades after World War II, the defense industry polluted the desert near Tucson's south side and poisoned the aquifer from which the largely Mexican-American neighborhood got its drinking water. Sonora Taylor, who was born there, reflects on lessons from the resident struggle and asks what a genuine remedy might look like. She discusses an environmentalism that recognizes that we all are or will become disabled and fights not just for the able-bodied, but to extend care to all, including the rest of the natural world. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. How do we fight harm to ourselves and to the natural world around us when both it and we have been disabled by capitalism? And what lessons can disability bestow upon us, not just about the devastation of ecosystems and human health, but also about connection and resistance? Sonora Taylor is Assistant Professor of Environmental Science, Policy, and Management at UC Berkeley. She's also an artist and writer, the author of Beasts of Burden, Animal and Disability Liberation. In her recent book, Disabled Ecologies, Lessons from a Wounded Desert, she returns to the neighborhood of her childhood, where defense contractors contaminated the Sonoran Desert and the water beneath it over many decades with a range of toxic chemicals and metals. Can you tell us more about the pollution of the aquifer in Tucson, Sonora? What was its source?
So the pollution came from defense industry contamination in on the south side of Tucson, Arizona. Some smaller industries, but also most of it actually came from Hughes Aircraft Company, which became Raytheon in the 1990s. And actually, after the publication of this book, switched its their name to RTX. So there were these weapons manufacturers, aircraft manufacturers on the south side of Tucson that established themselves really in the late 1940s, early 1950s, in a very rural area of Tucson. Actually, at the time, this was a rural neighborhood. It would increasingly become a largely Mexican-American neighborhood over the decades. But it was actually also right next to Tohono O'odham land, the Tohono O'odham Nation San Javier Reservation. So the pollution that came from these companies was largely various kinds of contaminants used in airplane degreasers, solvents, electronics manufacturing. Lead among the chemicals was trichloroethylene, or TCE. These contaminants were just dumped along the desert washes, along on the desert ground, along desert fences. And as contaminants do, they traveled, through the desert washes and ultimately into the ground and into the groundwater. And then the story that I tell throughout the book is, what happened after this, essentially.
And I would like to ask you more in a moment about how those pollutants migrated, but could you just situate what you've just described, the pollution of southern Tucson with the contamination from the defense industry? Can you situate that in the military-industrial complex?
This was the post-World War II era where there was a lot of anxiety from the broader Hughes industry about locating themselves somewhere where they felt less of a target. And so as a lot of various defense industries did at the time, they moved southwest. I think that this also has a lot to do with just the desert landscape, the understanding of this image of the desert as a place with less life. And Hughes also, I should say, established his facility there because he also had his own sort of attraction to the desert. He had this image of the desert as being clean and healthy, right? Which is, of course, all the more strange that then his very industry would be anything but that, right? Would be part of contaminating the desert and the wider industry. Not to mention just the weapons manufacturing industries themselves, right? You know, I mean, I think one of the stories that is kind of an undercurrent of the book is that the U.S. military is itself one of the leading causes of contamination, of the climate crisis, of environmental degradation, and has been for many, many decades, and yet can often is kind of left out of these environment when we're talking about the industries that are harmful for our planet, for the environment. We don't hear as much as we should about defense industries, which ultimately, right, what are defense industries but industries of death and destruction and disablement? That is what these industries sort of deal in, both of humans and communities, but also of land and water and ecosystems.
Starting in the 1940s, kind of ramping up in the 1950s, you had these defense companies dumping pollutants into these open pits that then spread throughout the area. Who and or what did the pollutants primarily affect?
Yeah, and this is really like the story that I tell in Disabled Ecologies, is sort of mapping out the impacts of this pollution, the material injuries both to human beings and to the wildlife and the broader ecosystem. This contamination at first impacted the Tohono O'odham Nation. Some of the first complaints about the contamination actually came from representatives from the Tohono O'odham Nation in the mid-1950s. And they actually sent a letter to city officials, to the water department, saying that they were opposed to Hughes Aircraft's dumping methods, that the contamination was coming onto their property and their animals were drinking it, their cattle were drinking it and dying, and that if something wasn't done about it, that this contamination would eventually seep into the groundwater and become a huge public health concern, not only for the animals and the wildlife, but for the people above. Nothing was done in response to this letter. And in fact, what happened was that a few years later, Hughes Aircraft actually built these enormous unlined lagoons, just enormous, to dump their chemical waste. So in fact, what happened after this letter was that the polluting increased. And by the time this contamination, seeped through the ground into the aquifer and then moved through the groundwater to the city's wells, the community above had, the population had grown, and it had become a largely Mexican-American neighborhood, in part due to various racist gentrification plans that had happened in other parts of Tucson that essentially pushed the Mexican-American community and neighborhoods into the south side of Tucson. So people on the south side, increasingly noticed that something was just not right. There were too many people getting sick, having coming down with serious illnesses, experiencing cancer. People's pets were dying. People's plants would die when they'd water them. And so they knew that something was wrong. This community knew something was wrong, even before it kind of officially exploded onto the public scene as when it was brought to light. So the contamination impacted the Southside community living there. The contamination also fundamentally altered the chemical makeup of the groundwater itself, of the aquifer itself. And one of the characters, sort of main characters, if you will, of the book is also the aquifer and what happened to the aquifer. The contaminants also impacted wildlife, impacted plant life. So, you know, one of the sort of more theoretical goals of the book is to give us a language to talk about how these environmental disasters, how these sites of environmental harm, you know, they don't just impact ecosystems on one side over here and then impact human beings in some other realm, right? That we really need a language to be able to see just how much injury to nature is injury to ourselves. And disabled ecologies is sort of that language for me. It's essentially a way of mapping out these trails of human and non-human injury that come from sites of environmental harm.
What is your connection to the story of the defense industry pollution in Tucson?
So this story is a very personal one to me on many levels. The book is not a memoir. It's not a sort of personal investigation of my own life or my own story. But my story is really important to the project, because I was raised with the understanding that my own disability, I identify as a disabled person, I use a power wheelchair. I grew up with the understanding that my own disability that I've had from birth was likely caused by this particular contamination on the south side of Tucson. I was born near the area in the early 1980s. And my family was part of the early kind of story around this site and also part of the lawsuit. So I grew up with this understanding that my disability is part of this story. But again, the book itself is not a memoir. I don't sort of dwell on this, on my own personal aspect of this story. But my origin story is really important because I think having this story offered me, as a young person growing up, sort of perspectives on two of the main ideas that would be really central to the book. So on one hand, I had an understanding, even as a very little kid, that disability wasn't just a medical problem, that it wasn't just my own individual problem, that disability is a political issue, that disability can emerge from environmental harm, from war, from environmental racism, right? I had an understanding that disability was inherently political in that way, and that disability could impact a whole community. I also had an understanding that that when we injure nature, it's not just something that happens over there in some, you know, other realm, right? That injury to nature is, again, injury to us. And I had a visceral understanding of the fact that humans are part of this network, right? And those two concepts, on some level, my understanding of disability and my understanding of nature, really are essentially, on some levels, what this book is about and is getting at. And so when I realized when I was working on my PhD that I wanted to turn my attention to the relationship between disability and environmental, the environmental arena and climate change, that I really needed to return to where my understandings of these concepts have actually developed. And so that's what kind of led me back to root these bigger sort of philosophical ideas in what specifically happened in Tucson.
And we'll talk more as we go on about how those elements have informed your understanding of what took place in Tucson and a broader sense of how should we think about our lives and the lives of non-human nature on an injured planet. I should say that I'm speaking with Sonora Taylor. She's Assistant Professor of Environmental Science, Policy, and Management at UC Berkeley. And her latest book is Disabled Ecologies, Lessons from a Wounded Desert. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So you're describing how people in the South Side of Tucson were suspecting that something was seriously amiss as rates of illness were increasing, that animals were getting sick, pets were getting sick. At what point was the pollution of Tucson's aquifer confirmed to the public at large? And how did that happen? That is, how was there confirmation that this was in fact taking place?
Yeah, so there were a few different things that happened. There was testing that happened at various Hughes wells that showed high levels of certain contaminants. And this happened, this was in the very late 1970s, 1978, 1979. Simultaneously, the Arizona Department of Health actually at the time was investigating various potential sites of contamination in the region. You know, it's one of these things where everyone kind of knew. Again, there had been this letter from the representatives from Tohono O'odham Nation for a decade prior. There had been other complaints from other people in the community, other neighborhoods that had been impacted from a more like surface water drainage from these plumes. There had also been employees who had called attention to it. So it was kind of one of these things where people knew, but Hughes had so much power in Tucson, you know, in terms of political power. They were one of the largest employers in the area. And so it was just kind of, you know, people turned away, city officials turned away, as so often happens in these cases. At a certain point in the early 1980s, a bunch of wells were closed down, and it kind of happened silently. There wasn't much. City officials basically did do a few comments on it, but they said essentially that, like, you know, no one received dangerous levels of contaminated water, and it was just kind of hushed up. There was an amazing local investigative journalist named Jane Kay, who, thank goodness, was on the environmental beat for the Arizona Daily Star at the time, had already written a few pieces about other things that Hughes Aircraft had done. And she had some colleagues who were also kind of connected to the Southside community, and piecing things together, essentially decided to investigate this further. Now, simultaneously, there were community members who were also kind of already doing their own sort of investigation, a variety of people who were in the school district. So various people who were either educators or, somehow involved with the school district, who were also community members who lived on the South Side, who kind of were already noticing and trying to piece together what was happening. So Jane Kay and a variety of people, of these school teachers and others, kind of came together. So a woman named Melinda Burnell, a variety of people who essentially kind of worked together to create this whole series, this sort of explosive series that detailed what Hughes had been doing, detailed the impacts on community, and essentially put together their own health study. When this was released in 1985, it was a huge kind of a bombshell of a piece or of a series, and really got things going in terms of drawing attention to what happened. And within about 2 months of the series coming out, the first set of the series, the community had officially organized into a group called Tucsonans for a Clean Environment, or TCE, which is the acronym for trichloroethylene, which is the main contaminant that was of concern at this site. So they organized people like Melinda Burnell, Eduardo Quintina, organized into this really formidable group just very shortly after the piece, the Jane Kay's series came out.
And how did officials deflect residents' concern, including as it was intensifying?
Yeah, this was one of the most disturbing aspects of this history, and unfortunately not at all uncommon. This is part of what people who have been calling to attention to environmental racism have been talking about for years. But what the city officials' essential line was that, yes, the people on the south side had disproportionate rates of illnesses, but this was not because of contamination. This was not because of pollution in the groundwater. This was because of the community's own lifestyle, own genetic predisposition to illness, own culture, literally what people ate. These, you know, very racist, ableist ways of not only trying to deflect blame, right, but trying to kind of invoke this sense of shame and guilt and internalization, which we see so often with disability, which I think is one of the reasons why it's so important to politicize disability, right? Because we know, right, that when one experiences illness or a bodily change, that there's these feelings of, oh, well, what did I do? What did I do wrong? Or what have I been doing to not take care of myself, right? That is sort of the way that our society kind of pressures us to feel about our own sort of embodiment. And so they were really playing off of this. And thankfully, the community just completely rejected this. And instead, at a time when, you know, this was the early 1980s, very kind of colorblind news reporting, there was not actually the language of environmental racism was not, that movement was really just forming. But of course, the Southside community understood this as racism. They understood this as a continuation of the kinds of racism and dispossession that their community had been experiencing for decades. And so they organized against this again and formed this group, Tucsonans for a Clean Environment. And one of their early sort of demands was the firing of city officials who were making such statements.
What about official science? What role did it play in the unfolding of both awareness of the pollution that had been taking place from the defense industry in Tucson and the way that it was channeled away from a broad sense of the injury and harm that was taking place and had been taking place for decades?
Yeah, so I think, again, what happened in Tucson is kind of, you know, a microcosm of what happens on a broader level when we, you know, kind of consistently put our faith in science as being able to figure out, right, whether something actually happened or not. And I say that delicately because I also do, you know, as an environmentalist, I also completely agree with, you know, the young people who are demanding that we trust, you know, that we trust science, right, in terms of climate change, right? So, but the problem with often how various studies are conducted in sites like this is that our science actually often, well, on one hand, can't necessarily match it. We don't actually have the tools to really be able to answer the kinds of questions that we need to be able to answer. And then often we don't have enough of the information to answer the questions. And so then what happens is that studies are done, but they are essentially designed to be inconclusive. And in fact, the early environmental justice movement, some of the research that was put out, this is part of the case that environmental justice movements have made, is that often these studies are inconclusive by design. So some of the examples of this, because city officials didn't act on their knowledge that Hughes Aircraft was dumping its waste into the desert and that waste was going into the groundwater, we didn't actually have clear documentation on what neighborhoods received what level of contaminants. We have a general sense, there's a general idea of what neighbors received that water, but there is not the kind of specific data that would then let us be able to correlate that with specific people who drank it. So then when health study officials would go in and they would ask, for example, you know, for these very clear correlations between how long someone had drank TCE and what their conditions were, oftentimes people can actually, you know, people had a general sense, they could intuit what had likely happened, but there wasn't the official data because that data was either lost or destroyed. So there's that aspect of it. There's also the fact that TCE or any chemical, right, the only way that we kind of officially recognize it as causing certain, as causing specific kinds of illnesses is after, you know, years and years of testing. But this means that you have to test a particular contaminant without factoring in that contaminant's potential interactions with other contaminants. At Hughes, we know that there were a variety of contaminants that were being used and dumped, right? So TCE is being tested in isolation when in fact it was a chemical soup. People's bodies also interact with chemicals very differently, right? Not everyone is going to react to a contaminant as an able-bodied 40-year-old white man might, right? There's different impacts on bodies at different life stages with people who have different conditions already. So there's all these ways that the whole structure of how we think about reining in chemical contaminants is flawed. So I think there's that aspect of it. I will say where, you know, where the science was, you know, where you kind of see the success of science in this story is in the geohydrologists who were doing really amazing work to kind of try to figure out how these contaminants would move in the groundwater, where they were moving to, how to recover pollutants from the water, how to treat the groundwater, how to treat the aquifer. So I don't want to at all sound like, science doesn't have a place in this, but there are all of these barriers to really create, particularly when it comes to health studies and the health impacts of contaminants, right? That we assume, well, if a chemical toxin hasn't been, you know, regulated yet, then it must be safe. But that's not actually how our sort of regulation system is set up.
Right. So perhaps then would it be fair to say that the issue isn't science itself as a methodology of understanding the world, but the fact that in this context and in the context of our society, it often is going to be reductionistic and conceived in narrow and political terms, like just as you say, since the whole system of regulation around chemicals is so flawed that the evidence that is drawn upon is going to be circumscribed at best, sometimes wrong, and then proving causation itself can be incredibly difficult when you're talking about large populations of people who have been affected for decades and decades.
Yes, absolutely. You know, and I'll add one other thing that is, so when various health studies, some health studies did come out that made clear correlations between TCE and conditions that people were experiencing on the south side. But there were other health studies that would come out that would be inconclusive. And the problem with that is that once a study came out that was inconclusive, right, then that kind of would kind of impact the momentum. It's not necessarily seen as inconclusive means that you can't decide either way, but how that would be interpreted or utilized by the polluters or by even city officials was often more as a sign that there wasn't something happening, right? There's not clear evidence that something's happening versus, oh, actually we don't have this we don't have the tools that we need to show that something's happening. And so at a certain point, the Tucsonans for a Clean Environment and other groups that were organizing essentially just said, you know, we don't want any more health studies. That health studies are just perpetuating this harm, essentially, because they continuously get people's hopes up that then this will be the proof, right? But then they're inconclusive. Or what often happens is that industries, and we see this again and again, the industries can say, well, maybe this study showed that something was happening, but more science needs to be done. We need more studies, right? And that can just happen, infinitely. You can constantly, industries can constantly demand that we need more studies, even when we have, you know, even when it's clear that something is happening. And so community essentially at a certain point said, you know, we don't want more health studies. We want healthcare. We want healthcare. We want, our aquifer to be cleaned up and a whole variety of other demands, but just a recognition of the real limitations of, and the sort of delay, the constant delay that's written into this whole health studies system.
So Nora Taylor is my guest. She teaches at UC Berkeley, and we're discussing disabled ecologies, lessons from a wounded desert. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So you mentioned that one of the ways that people tried to exert leverage on the city and the companies as a result of the contamination of the aquifers in Tucson was through litigation. Can you tell us briefly about that?
Yeah, so as a sort of a sign of how successful this movement was, they would eventually win a historic lawsuit. It was the biggest settlement for groundwater contamination up until that point. These lawsuits, they happened over a variety of years throughout the 80s and early 90s, but they were very successful. But even with successful lawsuits, right, there are, as you say, there are these sort of built-in limitations. In this case, this was not, it could not be a class action lawsuit because there were two, my understanding of it from speaking to the lawyers is that there was such a broad range of ailments, of illnesses, of disabilities that people were experiencing that it was, right, it was hard to make that specific correlation to this main contaminant that was the regulated contaminant at that time that was like the main concern, and so they had to kind of make their case without having that particular correlation. It wasn't like everyone was experiencing the same kind of cancer, for example, right? So there were a variety of reasons why it couldn't be a class action lawsuit, which means essentially that people who didn't know about it and who didn't participate at the time, there's nothing that they can do to be a part of that case. So it was very limited in terms of who it benefited. The lawyer was a Southsider himself, was very involved in the community and the organizing. And so really, I do believe that they worked really hard to get as many people to participate as possible. But of course, right, there's also people who weren't sick at the time, but didn't feel like they needed to or should participate, that they shouldn't take up a spot maybe that was should be for someone else. And then, you know, years later became sick. So the lawsuit was successful, but also on one level, the challenge of having a successful lawsuit is then it on some level there's this sense that then the story is closed, right? That success has happened, And this is one of the things that I'm really interested in with this story, but also, right, that Tucson also, there's countless stories like this across the country. I just did, I had the great experience of traveling around with this book for 2 weeks and went to different places, and everywhere that I would go, people were like, oh, this is the same thing is happening here in Baltimore, or the same thing is happening here in Athens, Georgia, or the same thing is happening here in Brooklyn, right? This, so these stories are not, they're anything but unique. We live with these kinds of stories all over. And so one of the things that I'm really interested in is what happens after, right, in the sort of long aftermath of what I call and what I think about as like living with injury, right? They had a successful lawsuit. The groundwater is being treated with state-of-the-art treatment facilities. There were various other kinds of successes the community got. They were, by all kind of measures on, pretty successful as organizers against environmental racism and against pollution, polluting industries go. But there's still people who have had no sort of closure or financial support or healthcare support. The environment is going to be, that groundwater is kind of perpetually altered. There's new contaminants from the same history that are every few years, every decade or so, kind of coming up as concerns themselves, as our technologies and understandings of various contaminants have become more of a concern. So part of the question that I'm asking, is what happens next? What happens when communities, have to go on living with their both injuries themselves, injuries to their community, but also injuries to their environments. What happens after the cameras have left, after the lawyers have left, even in a successful case like Tucson?
Right, and you argue that understanding a notion of disability is essential for thinking about that afterlife, because of course it's not just about the after. So I wanted to ask you about how concepts of disability were deployed in this struggle, let's call it, over the contamination of this area, the south side of Tucson, aquifer that was polluted in a primarily Mexican-American area over decades from the 1940s through the 70s. How was a notion of disability deployed on both sides during that struggle, which of course shape how one thinks about disability beyond it?
Yeah. So, I think maybe I'll just start by saying, I think a lot of people hear the word disability and they think, oh, that doesn't have anything to do with me. Disability is something that just impacts people in wheelchairs or just impacts people, who are blind or have some sort of clear, visible marker. One of the things that disability advocates and disability studies has shown for decades is that disability isn't just something that impacts, some few people. Disability impacts all of us. We all live in bodies that become injured, that become sick, that age, right? If we live long enough, we all will sort of age into disability. We all go in and out of disability and able-bodiedness. And so we all should be thinking about how our society either supports and understands that or sort of denies it and creates a sort of culture and systems and architectures that kind of don't acknowledge the fact that we all live in injured or all live in vulnerable bodies, right? That go in and out of needing care. And so I want to start with that because disability is a material reality that people experience. And here when I say the word disability, I think I'm thinking also about related concepts of, There's not clear differences, clear boundaries between disability and illness and sickness, right? Even the concept of health, what exactly do we mean by what is healthy, what is not healthy, right? These are all kind of terms that are kind of circulating the same family that I'm thinking about in this book. So disability is a lived reality. It's a material experience, right? That people live with. But disability is also, like race or gender or class, a concept that also shapes our world in different ways, and that is used for different ends. And I think particularly we see this when we think about notions of health, and again, what's healthy and what's not healthy. So I described earlier that to me, that one of the things that I was doing in Tucson was sort of mapping the trails of injury, both human injury and non-human injury. And to me, this is what I mean by a disabled ecology. Disabled ecologies can be understood as a sort of mapping project. I was really mapping the disablement that emerged from this site. But I was also mapping the way in which disability, and again, these related concepts, were also sort of deployed in the stories that we tell around the site, the stories that other people would tell around the site, sort of the narratives that were framed. You know, so we saw one really clear example in the way that city officials were using, right, a concept, the powerful sort of multiple meanings of a powerful concept like disability and illness distract blame, deflect blame from, you know, polluting industries and from the city itself onto the community, putting that blame right onto the community themselves. So that's one really clear way that disability kind of played out in the narratives. Disability and illness were also used on both sides of the litigation. So we could see, you know, again, sort of the defense lawyers kind of playing with the same concept that city officials were using. You know, when people were essentially sort of asked, you know, oh, well, are you sure that your illness isn't because, you know, you, how many years did you spend smoking, or what is your diet? Again, trying to deflect blame onto the community themselves. I remember that my own mom, my own parents had to fill out paperwork that asked them also, because my mother was pregnant with me at the time, right? And so that's where we see these issues even more sort of vividly as kind of around the blaming of pregnant mothers too. But disability and illness were also utilized by the community themselves, right? These experiences of illness were also shared and told as evidence that something had happened to their community, as evidence of racism. So that was another way that they were utilized. And there were particular kinds of modes of organizing that came from the experience of illness and disability. And then we could also see it in both sides of the public health debate. Like part of my method essentially was to follow both the material trails of disability, but also these narratives of disability. And I think my larger sort of reason for doing that is because this book on one level is really trying to make the case that disability is a really important part of the environmental arena. And yet it is not a part that has been sort of exposed or politicized. It is sort of hasn't been kind of explored and attention hasn't really been brought to it. And part of the reason why I think that disability is so important to the environmental arena is because as these examples already kind of show, in this particular case in Tucson, disability is already there. It's already there. It's unmarked. It's depoliticized. It's doing all sorts of work. And so for us to understand what it's doing, we need to mark it. We need to make it visible and politicize it. And, you know, I'll just add briefly that I'm in an environmental studies department. You know, I see that my You know, we in environmental studies, we work for, you know, healthy environments for healthy communities, right? We think about the health of forests, the health of soil, the health of rivers. So if health is what we're trying to achieve, then what is it that we are increasingly living with now, with pollution, with the climate crisis, with the extinction crisis? You know, what is the language that we can use to describe the kinds of injuries and harms that our ecosystems and our fellow creatures and us ourselves are experiencing? And I think that disability could be a helpful language and a helpful politics to understand that.
And thinking about the history of the environmental movement, you've had a long history of, especially in the United States, of a notion of kind of pristine, untouched nature, wilderness, and contrasted to the harm that humans can do. And that has turned out to be sort of a very problematic way of thinking about nature or the environment outside of us. And obviously, as you say, our struggles are around an injured planet and our injured selves on that planet, and how environmentalism, you know, broadly conceived, thinks of disability, you argue is really important in that. And I wonder if you could contrast for us the distinction that you make between a broad environmentalism of the injured, as you term it, and the problems with what you call an ableist ecology or ableist ecologies and a way of thinking about the environment.
Yeah, thank you so much for the question. So, you know, I think for me, disability, as I was saying a minute ago, is already present within the environmental arena. And if anything, I think that because of the the devastation that fossil fuel industries, big meat, war industries are having on our environments, that disability is just going to be an increasing sort of powerful marker, concept, but also something that we all live with, right? And so the question for me becomes, what are we going to do with that? On one level, I see a way in which disability is used for a sort of eugenics vision, or a sort of in a sort of ableist way, as a fear-mongering tactic, right? That's not meant to sit with the injury and think and reflect on, okay, how can we support and care for and create a world livable for those who are already injured, right? For our injured fellow creatures, for our injured human beings, for our injured environments. But how can we, you know, kind of shore up our own and protect our own resources? How can we kind of just protect the able-bodiedness that remains, essentially, right? And so I see this on one side as a sort of ableist ecology that uses the potency, the symbolic potency of disability as a fear-mongering tactic, but not in an effort to make the world more accessible or livable for the injured, right? And that's not just theoretical. We know that disabled people are, you know, for one thing, disability is fundamentally intersectional, right? We know that disabled people are disproportionately impacted by the climate crisis at every stage. It's harder for disabled people around the world to leave, to migrate. It's harder for disabled people to prepare for incoming disasters. It's harder for our systems to figure out what kind of rescuing needs to happen, right? So this isn't just a sort of theoretical conversation. It has real impacts on who is being impacted by these crises. And so I identify, in contrast to that, what I'm thinking about is an environmentalism of the injured. And I don't think about that as a specific, necessarily even a specific movement or a specific, or that it should replace other kinds of movements that, or other kinds of frames that we have for different environmental movements, but more as a sort of a thread that I think has always existed through environmental thinking that has thought about disability differently. Where disability and illness have, yes, been part of the impetus for environmentalism, right? Whether it's because of harm to communities, injury to communities or injury to landscapes, but where that harm hasn't been sort of used to justify abandonment, but instead where people have thought about how to make the world more livable for the injured themselves, right? And to not abandon those landscapes and communities and people who've experienced that disablement and injury. So I think, you know, that disability to me is going to be an increasingly, you know, again, sort of powerful signifier. And what we do with that is an important question, right? Are we going to learn from disabled activists, from disabled communities, from people who've long experienced disablement about how to live with disability and how to create more humane, just, interdependent communities in this damage that we are living in? Or are we going to do the opposite and just, you know, unfortunately, just fall back on these very racist, xenophobic, and ableist sorts of, you know, survival of the fittest, you know, getting all the resources that we can for ourselves dynamic in this time of climate crisis. So those are some of the ways that I think those two different ideas are playing out, how I see them playing out and how I write about them.
Sadly, we're totally out of time. Sonora Taylor, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Sonora Taylor is the author of Disabled Ecologies, Lessons from a Wounded Desert. She's also the author of Beasts of Burden, Animal and Disability Liberation. She's assistant professor of environmental science, policy management at UC Berkeley. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.